Hello and welcome to A History of Christian Theology. My name is Chad Kim. This week I'll be talking with my good friend and neighbor, Andrew Martin. He has written The Covenant with Moses and the Kingdom of God, Thomas Hobbes and the Theology of the Old Covenant in Early Modern England. So Dr. Martin began this work as a dissertation at Vanderbilt University, and he is now the Associate Professor of Systematic Theology at Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. And also our sons are best friends, so I really enjoyed this chance to talk with Drew about some of his more academic work. And he really helps us think a little bit about Reformed theology, the importance of the Reformed view of two covenants, and how that intersects with political thought in England. And so we talk a little bit about Thomas Hobbes and some of the other stuff that was going on in England, the civil wars and other things that led to the kind of broadly Reformed theologians thinking about how society should be organized. And so we talk a little bit about that, a little bit about the Westminster Confession. Many years ago, we talked about having someone with a Reformed background on the podcast who knew the Reformed tradition really well. So I'm excited to have Drew on and talk about that. Also, I just wanted to call your attention to the Patreon stream. We're getting a lot of stuff out there. We're getting new supporters. So I want to thank Lauren Ware for her support. And even Karen Wagner gave us some comments. And there's just a lot going on there. So within the Patreon, if you're a Patreon supporter, you can have conversations about some of our podcasts right there on the Patreon. So that has been really great to see that community build and grow. So if you'd like to join it, please, we would appreciate it. It helps keep the podcast running, helps me keep things organized, and Grant keeps Grant around, and he keeps me on task. So thank you all for your support and your comments. We have a lot of good stuff coming up on both streams. So in terms of conversations, I'm preparing a conversation with Jamie Kreiner on John Cassian. It's called How to Focus, A Monastic Guide for an Age of Distraction. We're also going to talk with Brad Littlejohn about why Protestants convert to Catholicism. So there's going to be a lot of good conversations and a lot of different kinds of conversations I'm really looking forward to. Also on the Patreon stream, we're going to release one where Tom Trevor and I talk about Thomas Aquinas and his view of the Incarnation. I hope to start doing some different stuff on there, including some talks that I've given on the development of the canon, possibly some of my research on purgatory. So I think there'll be a lot of good stuff out there on the Patreon. So this has been plenty long of an introduction, but I do thank you all for your support. And here's my conversation with Drew Martin. All right. Well, this morning I'm pleased to be speaking with my friend, neighbor, fellow congregant. We have Dr. Drew Martin, Andrew Martin. And Drew has published his dissertation, The Covenant with Moses and the Kingdom of God, Thomas Hobbes and the Theology of the Old Covenant in Early Modern England. Like all good, library book style dissertations, you got a pretty long title, but that's just like mine and everyone else's.
You got to get all the keywords into the title so that it can be found.
That's right. Yep, that's right. So, as the joke indicated, this, like I say, this comes from his dissertation. It's one of these books. This might be not so easily accessible to the average listener, there are a lot of interesting tidbits and some history that I did not know very well. And listeners will know certainly pretty quickly that this is pretty far afield from the historical eras that I tend to cover, which is, I read most of the stuff that goes along with patristic theology, because that's kind of what I do. But I was realizing this morning as I was preparing for the interview that early on, Tom, Trevor, and I mentioned that we should have someone who is more well-versed in you know, what the Westminster Confession and the sort of historical Reformed tradition. And so I don't know, what are we 8 years on in the podcast? I have the associate professor of systematic theology at Covenant Seminary finally on a podcast. So welcome, Drew.
Well, thanks, Chad. It's so great to be with you and a privilege to be able to talk about the book. And thank you for allowing an early modernist historian and theologian of Reformation theology to join your conversation. So grateful to be here.
Yeah. Well, and so, like I say, I'm so glad to have him. We've had good conversations off the podcast. And so now we're going to try to bring him on. And as my joke sort of alluded to at the beginning, we haven't had someone really come on, well-versed in this Reformation theology and in the Reformed tradition as you are. And so I thought we would just start with like laying out the basics of covenant theology. This is the conversation that you're entering into. Although that being said, the book is, of course, has a lot of more detail and just sort of broad historical theory, political theory, historical theology. So your book definitely goes across several different disciplines. But what is probably most interesting to my listeners tends to be on the more theological side. But this idea of covenant theology is critical to what it means to do Reformed theology. And so I thought you could just sort of lay out like how that, like just, you know, a sort of a quick pitch for what that even means.
Sure. Well, thanks for that question. And one of the main points of the book is that what we mean by covenant theology is something that develops over time. And there's quite a spectrum of views related to this topic. And those views develop in conversation with various social, cultural, and political questions. And so that's all just a big caveat for what I'm getting ready to do, which is to try to give one way of thinking about covenant theology, which is basically just a summary of the one that's in the Westminster Confession of Faith, and that's related to the time period of the book. So I'll just narrate that view, and then hopefully that will lead to some questions. But basically, the view that's in the Westminster Confession of Faith is built upon a distinction between a covenant of works that's made with Adam in the garden. And that one is set in contradistinction to a covenant of grace that is made with Christ and then administered temporally after the fall. And so really, that's the most fundamental distinction that organizes the system. But you can say more than that. If you want to say a little bit more than that, you might observe that the covenant of works that's made between God and Adam in the garden is a conditional covenant that requires perfect and perpetual obedience to God's law. And the second covenant, the one that's made with Christ, also has conditions, and namely that there's faith in Christ. But God not only promises that Christ will come, but also that he will give faith to all of those he chooses by the work of the Holy Spirit. And so he actually makes it possible for the condition to be fulfilled. So there is a condition, but God is the one who fulfills it in Christ and then makes it possible for people to believe in him. Now, it's also important to say that in the Westminster Confession of Faith, there's no specification related to the mediators of that covenant. Mm. So there's no extended discussion of how the biblical covenants with Noah or Moses or Abraham or David or even the new covenant, how exactly they relate to one another, how they fit together. There's just some general statements that these are various administrations of the one covenant of grace. So there's one covenant of grace that superintends both the Old and New Testaments. And yet, so there's both distinction between Old and New, but there's no clear narrative of exactly how to break that down, which is one of the reasons that there end up being a lot of debates about how exactly you understand the covenant of with Moses in relation to that covenant of grace, which is the subject of this book. I guess the only other thing maybe to add to that would be that in addition to chapter 7 of the Westminster Confession of Faith, which sets forth that basic system that I just narrated, the other major place in the Westminster Confession of Faith that talks about the covenant of Works and Covenant of Grace is chapter 19, which is about the law of God. And so in that chapter, it talks about the moral law being given originally to Adam, but then that same law is delivered to Moses. And it can even use the language or the idea of a republication of that moral law, which is then summarized in the Ten Commandments. And so that law that's given to Adam in the Garden of Eden and then again to Moses is a manifestation of God's eternal law, and so therefore is binding in all places at all times for both believers and unbelievers. And then the Confession of Faith draws various different implications of that. But the primary one would be that the moral law is something that should still be followed today. But then that raises the question, if the moral law is still to be followed today, to what extent should various other laws in the Old Testament be enforced by the civil magistrate? And that's why the book engages with both covenant theology, but also the role of the magistrate in relation to law. So those concepts are inseparable. And even the way the confession narrates them, it makes it difficult to completely dissociate them or not to talk about them at the same time.
Yeah. So there's so much there for a person like me. And although I am somewhat theologically educated and literate, I feel illiterate when I start hearing these kind of things. And I'm like, I've been around Presbyterian circles my whole life. And I was like, even as you were explaining it, I was like, oh yeah, the covenant of works specifically refers to Adam first. And like, it might just like, when I heard it, when I first hear these terms, I think I sort of associate it with Exodus, Ten Commandments, and the latter part. I don't think I sort of with like in my just like hearing the terms, I would have thought the covenant of works would have referred to the Old Testament broadly, and the covenant of grace would refer to the New Testament, like just the way those terms work, and the way that the Bible separated and the sort of and maybe it's an influence of dispensational theology or other things. But like, it's, you know, even that, like, I'm like, oh, right. Okay. I got to have those anchored correctly.
Oh, sure. And to be fair, the language of do this and live, you know, a command for you to do something is a command that certainly does appear in a wide variety of contexts throughout the Old Testament and also in relation to the covenant with Moses. And clearly there are significant legal components to the covenant with Moses. And so it's not surprising, therefore, that in the history of Christian theology, and certainly within the Reformed tradition, that people will talk about the covenant with Moses and have various ways of construing how it is related to the covenant of works. And in fact, there's at least four different views of how to unpack that I talk about in the book that are very prominent in the 17th century. So it's not surprising that you would think that way. People have talked that way, and in fact, people continue to talk that way. The real issue is not about talking that way, but what do you mean when you do talk that way? What do you mean by the covenant with Moses and its relation to the covenant of works? How are you using those terms?
Yeah. And it also just, I mean, and this is a problem that any Christian theologian, broadly speaking, would have to have to deal with. I don't know. This is something I don't think I put in our questions, but it also raises questions about divine simplicity, I guess. How, you know, insofar if God has multiple covenants that seem to be contingent, how can there be one act of you know, so in sort of kind of the ancient metaphysics, God is what God does, and there can't be multiple moves within that, or else God would change his being, which, in again, it would be contrary to what it means to be God. I don't know. Does that do the divines sort of think along these terms, or is that are these ancient terms that that they're not as much worried about?
No, they absolutely are aware of those issues and engaging with them. And one thing that's probably helpful to say is that when we were speaking of different covenantal administrations and differences between the way that God administers his law or God's law, we're talking about temporal arrangements. within the economy of salvation.
Okay.
And so we're talking about ways that are all consistent with who God is and what is true. So God's will and God's mind are one, and these are just different temporal manifestations of how God administers these things. And there is this whole other conversation that I don't get into much in the book about a covenant of redemption. Mm-hmm. And people talk about the covenant of redemption as an eternal covenant within the Godhead. And then, of course, that does raise a variety of questions in relation to divine simplicity that the early modern authors are quite sensitive to. In fact, there's this place where John Owen talks about it at great length. So your listeners who are interested can probably find that pretty easily via Google, that place where John Owen talks about the relationship between divine simplicity and the covenant of redemption. But here, the main point is just to say that we're only talking about the way in which God administers temporal affairs.
Okay. And so, and I realize, like, as I say, that we're, you know, we're going hard on the theology here and less on the history. But that history, the historical component is interesting as it relates to the, also the political theory. So just to connect those dots, one of the other points that you made was, okay, so if there is this law about how God wants us to act, and there is a question of who, as you say, who is going to enforce it? And that is one of the major strands that you pick up here. And so it's important for your work that all of this is situated within the 17th century in England. Could you tell, actually, let's stop there. So just some of the what's going on in England that occasions all of these kind of questions about how does one administer how does a magistrate fit within how God would like people to act? And I think ultimately this will connect to Thomas Hobbes, the other part of your work. But yeah, so say a little bit about, okay, so why is this a question then?
That's great. Well, so one of the things that's helpful for listeners to know is that the Westminster Confession of Faith that we've just been talking about and the system of theology that we've just been describing was written during the English Civil Wars. And the theology of the covenants that's in the Westminster Confession of Faith was achieved as a result of significant debates. There were significant differences on these things, and the confession is an attempt to narrate a consensus view on these matters. And the consensus that develops is one that was developed predominantly by the Presbyterians at the Assembly. Though there were other figures at the Assembly, most notably Congregational Independents, who held very different views about these matters. And so the relationship between the covenant with Moses and the covenant of grace and the implications of conclusions related to debates about it were inseparable from conversations about proper church government or the relationship between temporal and spiritual authority, and a host of other questions. And one thing I think is important to say, you can't, in a one-to-one way, map different covenant theologies to different ecclesiologies in an overly simplistic way. And at the same time, it's important to observe that these conversations are always connected to one another. And covenant theology is at the heart of how people debate these things. And so the reason that Thomas Hobbes enters into this conversation is that people think of Thomas Hobbes as a political philosopher. Now, fortunately, that's become much more nuanced over the last 20 or 30 years. John Pocock once said that, I'm going to paraphrase, but he basically said that the way that people read Hobbes is that the theological things he said weren't there, or if people did observe that they were there, they would then say he didn't really mean them. And nowadays it's much more common for people to take Hobbes seriously when he makes theological arguments, which is a lot of what he's doing across his theological works. But just to give some examples from Leviathan, his most famous political work, in that work, he takes positions on almost all of the things that we've just been talking about. How many covenants are there is a question that he addresses in chapter 35. What were those covenants, pre-lapsarian covenants in the Garden of Eden, or were they post-lapsarian covenants after the Garden of Eden? And did they require a mediator? Those questions get addressed in a variety of places, but the mediator question explicitly is addressed in chapter 16. Should the covenants that God makes with humanity be thought of as covenants of works or covenants of grace? He addresses those questions in chapter 43 and chapter 14. He even takes a position on whether or not Adam's reward in the Garden of Eden would have been continued life in the garden or eternal life in chapter 38. And he also, and most significantly to the book, he talks about the relationship between the Mosaic covenant and the new covenant in chapter 35. So Thomas Hobbes is invested deeply, not just at the surface level of these conversations, but way down deep into the weeds or the nitty gritty. He's interested in the micro details of covenant theology.
Yeah. Well, and one of the major points that we've just been going over, and I am actually going to skip ahead of some of the questions for a minute, is the relationship. So you've been talking a lot about Moses. So where does Moses fit? One of the early figures who I had never heard his name, Robert Sanderson, I think is one you do in chapter two. But some of these early figures, they are sort of offering a schema where you have three covenants. So you have a covenant of works and then a mixed covenant and then a covenant of grace. And then I guess that's where Moses fits in. So is Moses the one who governs the mix, or the one who's the mediator of the mixed covenant? And that, so some all of this is where, like, and actually Thomas Hobbes has an opinion on each one of these things. And so it is kind of, well, it's also kind of interesting. One of the other points you make in that first chapter or the second chapter is that even the word Leviathan or the use of the Leviathan, which becomes so associated with Hobbes, is actually found in some of these earlier debates. But, you know, that's sort of interesting historical footnote in a way, but it just highlights how connected Hobbes is to the theology.
Oh, absolutely. And so just to say a little bit about Sanderson and then to go to some of the other things that you mentioned, one of the reasons that I spend a good bit of time talking about Robert Sanderson in the book is to illustrate that covenant theology is not something that's only done by Puritans.
Mm.
But Robert Sanderson is a conformist bishop who is rabidly opposed to Puritans.
Mm.
And it's important to illustrate that there's a wide range of people who are doing covenant theology from a wide range of ecclesiological and political perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, the views that Hobbes sets forth in Leviathan in 1651 are anticipated by the views that Robert Sanderson is preaching several decades earlier in the 1600s. So there's a long durée to some of these positions. And so you're noting some of that. There is in the literature some treatments of other conformist bishops or representatives of the Church of England, but they tend to be Laudians, advocates of William Laud, like Henry Hammond or Herbert Thorndike. If they're not Laudians themselves, they overlap significantly in different ways with those views. Sanderson is very different from them. He's much less interested in protecting the authority of the clergy, but rather what he wants to do with some of those arguments is to shore up the authority of the civil magistrate. And so Hobbes really picks up on a lot of the arguments that Sanderson is making, which is not to say he's reading Sanderson, but rather just to say that these kinds of views are out there. They're not that uncommon. And so it's not surprising that Hobbes would then take them up later in the 1600s. So then, related to your other observation about how do people think about the covenant with Moses, the main thing to say for Hobbes's purposes is that Hobbes wants to make the covenant with Moses the paradigmatic covenant. And also, especially for thinking about political authority, he wants to make the case that the situation for England in his own day was exactly the same as that of Israel under the covenant with Moses. So you have a integrated church-state nexus. And in his view, that means that you have a civil magistrate who is overseeing the work of the priests. And so the views that various other figures in England at that time want to articulate are very different from that. And the main point there is that arguments for covenantal continuity. So is the covenant with Moses still enforced today in the same way? Have a lot to do with arguments for different kinds of temporal polity and how the church and the state are going to relate to one another as a result of that.
Yeah. And just to try to like, so when I was reading your book, I, you know, sometimes I would get lost in the details and trying to keep my mind wrapped around all of these figures that you named. Like I've, you know, like any, you know, undergraduate, I don't think I've read all of Leviathan. I have only read sections. So most of the stuff probably that you're referencing about him taking debates on the theology, all of this is excised in these like abridged versions that you probably get in a civics class or something. Or probably did an intro to political philosophy or something.
Yeah. No, that's literally true. They would publish Leviathan without the last half of it. They would say, "Oh, that's just the theological part. It's not relevant to political theory." And they would only publish the front half of the book. Some of those collections that were used in some seminar settings. So, yeah.
Yeah.
You may have actually had one of those copies. I don't know.
I probably do. If it's not behind me directly, it's at my parents' basement. To sort of connect it to the modern day. I mean, as you were saying all this, like, I'm not super engaged in tweeting among people, but there is like a big debate about Christian nationalism. There are big contemporary debates about, what is the role of Christianity to the state? And, you know, I think we've had like in weird ways, it's like, it almost seems like it's unsettled. And so the way that I was trying to kind of highlight this, I did send this to you. I reread the Westminster Confession before I became a member of the Greystone Institute, and I had to agree to the three forms of unity and some other stuff. So I was rereading a lot of these Reformed confessions and things, just in good conscience, so I knew what all that stuff was, because I had been only reading Augustine and ancient stuff for so long. But in the version of the Westminster Confession that I ended up finding from Schaff, it has the original language in it, which says something like. I typed it out. Yet the civil magistrate hath authority, and it is his duty to take order that unity and peace be preserved in the church, that the truth of God be kept pure and entire, that all blasphemies and heresies be suppressed, all corruptions and abuses in church and discipline prevented, and all ordinance of God duly settled, administered, and observed. For the better effecting whereof he hath power to call synods to be present at them and to provide that whatsoever is transacted in them according to the mind of God. I was just like, wait, what? I mean, I'm an American raised as a Southern Baptist. So, you know, like historically Baptists, although I guess they're forms of Baptist Christian nationalists now, which seem like in a historical anathema to me. But, you know, what do I know? But we can hold at bay that. So to go into this sort of the history here, there was a Westminster Confession that still in weird ways, I mean, mirrored exactly what we see in the Council of Nicaea, called by the Emperor Constantine. So in some ways, it looks like nothing has changed for 1,000 years. You still have this tight connection between how our temporal affairs are arranged by some kind of governmental authority. I don't know. I just was surprised to see that in the Westminster Confession. But having read your book, I think that connects a lot more tightly to the point that you're making. These, you know, it's only an American, or at least a more contemporary modern, I don't even want to use the word modern, a more contemporary person who would think, well, that has nothing, you know, what the government does has nothing to do with the church does, with what the church does. But this is decidedly not the case.
That's right. There are some conversations that have been going on for a long time in the early modern period, but that are happening in a new way that really do shape how we understand the relationship between temporal and spiritual power. And for Americans who are very used to the separation between church and state understood in a particular kind of way, it's very difficult to conceive of how Christians in the past talked about these things. And of course, that's a whole separate conversation from the conversation about when was the church right, or has the church ever been right in the way that it's answered this question. That's a whole nother conversation about which of these arrangements is best. But I think you're absolutely right to highlight that the original Westminster Confession of Faith, in its chapter on the civil magistrate, had a very strong view of the connection between temporal and spiritual power and the magistrate's authority in relation to spiritual things, even to call synods, which you also see in the chapter on synods and councils, chapter 31 of the original Confession of Faith. And so it's probably good for people to know that the version of the Westminster Confession of Faith that's used by American Presbyterians is a revised version of the original. And so in 1788, just after the Constitutional Convention has been meeting, the Presbyterians are meeting in the Synod of Philadelphia in New York, and they adopt a revised version of the Westminster Confession of Faith that removes the power of the civil magistrate over the church and various ecclesiastical matters. And that's the version that most Presbyterians in America use today. But Presbyterians, for example, in Scotland are more likely to be using the original version, depending on which kind of Presbyterian they are. I'll leave that for some other folks to adjudicate, though.
Yeah, well, so I was trying to remember, like, in the signers, what is it, of the Declaration of Independence, like, George Witherspoon, wasn't he, like, one of the really committed Presbyterians? So he might have been, is he involved then in the separating out of this language?
Yeah, he certainly is involved and is definitely a Presbyterian, and there's some good recent studies on him that people could go to on that topic for sure. Yep.
Well, I did my MDiv at Princeton Seminary, and it has a kind of weird place in the history of American religion and American, especially Presbyterianism. But, you know, we had Witherspoon Street, and, you know, George Witherspoon is on the campus of the university and all these sorts of things. So, and then, well, I mean, there's a whole other story about the relationship between Princeton Seminary and the university, which are separate institutions in most discernible ways. But anyway, I was just connecting some of the names that I had in mind there. But
yeah, well, and just to be clear, so there's a whole conversation there to be had about which version of the Westminster Confession of Faith is the superior one. And your opinion about that is going to be shaped by a whole host of things. And one of the things that I would love for us to have on the table as we think about that question and as we try to answer it is how does our covenant theology or our whole theological system lead us to answer those questions? And are there theological commitments we have in relation to revelation, Christology, ecclesiology, and eschatology that might help us to answer those questions? And it seems to me that there is a significant tension in the original Westminster documents between their doctrine of revelation, Christology, ecclesiology, and eschatology on the one hand, and their understanding of civil authority on the other. And so in my personal opinion, the American revisions make the confession as a whole much more consistent internally. So I see, I take them to be an improvement, but I also understand why some people want to cite those changes. And they're also nervous about, you know, the trajectory of things going on politically. And I understand why they're critical of those changes. But nevertheless, I tend to think they're not bad ones. I think they're good ones.
Yeah. Well, and as I was reading your book and preparing for this interview, I am also translating Augustine on the Donatus controversy. I was telling someone the other day, it's pretty funny to hear the arguments from this certain Donatus called Gaudensius that Augustine is engaging with in one of the works that I'm reading. And Augustine has the side of the tribune and the government. And so he's telling this Donatist, hey, look, the government, the Christian government is telling you that you should be on our side. You should listen. And Donatus, and in this case, is this guy called Gaudentius, but he is giving all the American, all the arguments that an American would give. Hey, it's not up to the government to tell me how to rule my ecclesiastical affairs.
And
I was just laughing. I was like, well, Americans, are we Donatists? Like, especially American Presbyterians? Yeah. Like,
well, I mean, one of the reasons that I'm glad you brought that up is that there is this tendency nowadays to act as if this distinction between religion and politics is a completely modern distinction. And when and there's a certain I'm not trying to dismiss that conversation. There is a certain helpfulness about having that conversation and making sure that we're clear about what we mean when we say religion, because that word just gets used in all sorts of sloppy ways, as I think we all know now. But the ability to distinguish between sacred things and profane things, or religion or threskeia and other, people have been making those distinctions since Augustine's day, as you're noting. There's someone who's conversing with Augustine who's wanting to make those distinctions. Anyone who's ever read the epistle to Diognetus, or however you say it, how do you pronounce it? You're the expert on that.
Diognetus, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. I mean, clearly some of those distinctions are being made in that writing. And so I think the argument that the distinction between sacred and profane is a purely early modern or modern invention is just demonstrably false.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and I mean, now I'm going to go, this podcast is supposed to be a conversation with you, but it just makes me want to, the distinctions that I drew when I was teaching for the Greystone Institute on the Confessions is I say that like, it just doesn't neatly map as much as we want to. I mean, religion is always going to be a contested term. But what I would say is something like Augustine thinks that true religion has a lot more in, well, maybe not a lot more, but at least has to incorporate what the ancients would have called philosophy. And to that extent, no American wants, like you say, well, if you're a religious, you're a philosopher or something. And they're going to be like, well, what are you talking about? Anyway, at the very least, there's not a one-to-one correspondence. And so, you know, religio in the ancient sense meant to bind together. So for Augustine, it was like, well, you're unbound and you're unbound to the state. But, you know, at the same time, he wanted to poke holes at how the pagans understood their religio because it didn't take into account how one acted. Which was philosophy, right? Philosophy was more concerned with how you acted in the world. If that was the case, then he says that the religion is false. But even he is using that term in various ways cutting against the grain for his period, because Christianity, they thought, like, you know, Justin Martyr and Augustine and all the early Christians, you know, there's a reason Justin Martyr wears the philosopher's robe and these sorts of things. Like, he, you know, they think of themselves as encompassing more than just what the ancients thought of as religio.
Oh, that's wonderful. So, I mean, the way that you said it, that people have been contesting the meaning of the word religio since forever, to paraphrase, that's a wonderful way to say it. And that related to that, people have been observing the intersection between their faith and everything else that they hold to or do. People have always seen the intersections between these things. And also Christians have historically also wanted to make distinctions between some of these things. And there's the history of Christian theology is in many ways the history of debates about exactly how to do that. So yeah. Yes, exactly.
And I'll just to put a coda on my point about our American Presbyterians Donatists, I would just say that I don't think that they are, because in this particular tract, what Augustine is trying to get the government to do is to stop Gaudentius from burning churches filled with his fellow Donatists. And so he's saying, please, please stop lighting your own people on fire. And, you know, so I don't think that that's what American Presbyterians are up to. It was a kind of a funny line, but not at all representative of why, you know, what was actually going on.
So we might want to read Augustine in his own context and not assume that he's defending every single version of force them to come in or compel them to come in or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, hey, there are a bunch of innocent people that are getting lit on fire. Please, please, can you stop?
Uh-huh. I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
But it does, so it does raise this interesting question about the relationship between the church and the state. And let's see. I want to do one more connected kind of question that is like, so part of what you argue for at the beginning of the book is that what Hobbes thought that he was doing was in Leviathan was trying to find a way to adjudicate peacefully the wars of religion, and so you have all of these people, as you point out in the book, some of them are Presbyterians, some of them are conformists, nonconformists, all different sorts, who are using covenantal theology of various ways. And so there's a whole bunch of options on the table. Hobbes has his own very peculiar version of all of these, maybe. But what he sees himself doing is trying to find a way to prohibit what he would have taken, maybe, and you can maybe explain this, but that is religious people from having wars and causing a bunch of problems. And this is a pretty standard narrative, right? So a lot of people, you know, when they think about like, okay, what is the history of the West? Well, after the Reformation, you start having all these different religious groups and they all start warring with each other. The Lutherans are going after the Catholics, and together they're going after the radical reformer Anabaptists. And then, you know, even before that, you have, you know, the Moors in Spain. And, you know, before there was the modern enlightened self, all of these Christians and various types of Christians are killing each other, Christians, Muslims, what have you. But we were saved because we had really good political philosophy that ultimately led to, the modern nation state or something, which can somehow stop all of these people from killing themselves because of their religion. When I was thinking about this, I have in mind, like, David Bentley Hart has a way to kind of undo this overly simple narrative. William Kavanaugh has a great book there's also a lecture on YouTube that you can watch that's kind of a summary of his argument about why these are false stories. But you at least have some idea that this is an overly simple narrative about religious people just always want to kill themselves, and the modern nation state that begins to be conceived with Hobbes kind of helps us stop killing each other. So do you care to respond to that and how that fits with the kind of work you're doing?
Sure. Well, maybe just start by saying that the arguments that you're summarizing from Kavanaugh, the myth of religious violence, and then he expands on it in the Migrations of the Holy and various other places, I find lots there that's helpful, and especially perhaps his problematizing of the word religion, which he does especially in the myth of religious violence. And I find much else helpful about the way in which he and Hart also in the Atheist Delusions, I'm guessing is your reference there, problematize this sort of myth that there are these religious wars that are easily distinguishable from secular wars, and religion tends to be violent and so forth. So there's lots that's helpful there. One other angle into that conversation that intersects with the historiography of early modern England is that the conversation about whether the English civil wars were religious or not is itself a bloodbath. So ironically, I suppose, but there's a very famous or infamous article that John Morrill wrote in the 80s called The Religious Context of the English Civil War, in which he concluded the paper with this very provocative line. He says, the English Civil War was not the first European revolution. It was the last of the wars of religion. Mm. And when he said that set off a whole it was a symptom of conversations already happening. And then it really did set off a whole series of other conversations where people were debating about to what extent were the English Civil Wars a war of religion, or to what extent were they motivated by other factors? And you get people making arguments on all sides of that question. And I think when you read that literature, it's helpful to have a book like Kavanaugh's in mind, because you immediately want to start problematizing, well, what do you mean by religion in all of these conversations? And oftentimes it's the case that there's not a very clear definition of religion, or there's significant equivocation on the use of that word, and it causes a whole host of problems. So that's all to say, it does seem like there certainly is a myth that there are some particularly notorious wars of religion, and that the state is the solution to that. And I find Kavanaugh helpful in all those ways. I think the other thing maybe to say, pushing from the other side just a little bit, would be, it seems to me sometimes that Kavanaugh wants to just reject essentialism altogether in his treatment of religion. So mm-hmm. basically, if we can't agree about what religion is, we're just going to avoid defining it. And so everything becomes religion. Nothing is not religion. And to me, if everything is religion, well, then haven't we just switched the conversation? We've just punted the conversation. It seems to me that there is actually something called religio, which is something that you can talk about in a way that is distinguishable from other things. And so I think the question is not whether we're going to describe religion in an essentialist kind of way. Everyone actually is doing that, mm-hmm. whether they admit it or not. I think we should all just admit that that's what we're doing, and then go on doing what we're doing, but just do it better and more self-consciously. Everyone is defining religion in these conversations, and everyone is working with a different understanding of what religion is. So let's all define the understanding that we're working with, and then say how it differs from others, or how it's similar to others, and how that informs our treatment of something like war or violence or whatever else it might be. So where I might push on Kavanaugh would be to say, no, let's keep essentialist definitions and let's just name them.
Yeah. Yeah. So and I realized, like, I gave a kind of intro and then I didn't summarize Kavanaugh's argument, but yeah, the myth of religious violence, like you say, he really does. He says that actually, like, we can look at, like, you know, communist forms of violence, and, you know, those are specifically atheistic, right? So you're not allowed to be religious in Russia or what have you, and so, you know, so then in that case, do we not call it religion? Do we call it religion? And that's, you know, this is the kind of the question that he raises. I highly recommend. I think there's some version of even the book is great, but there's even there's like an hour long lecture that he has on YouTube where you can. I'll try to get. Grant will put a note in the show notes to it, but it's very provocative. It's kind of funny. I didn't think when I started our conversation that we could almost title this, "What Do We Mean by Religion?" and somehow that has become a thread in the last 45 minutes. But
yeah. No, I think rightly so. So just to make sure that my own point was clear, the place where I might want to caveat some of the arguments he makes relates to whether or not there is something that is religious that is analytically separable from politic or economic causes. Uh-huh. I think he would say there is not, and I would say I think there is.
Yeah.
But where I would agree with him would be that the myth of religious violence, that there is this uniquely bad thing called religion, which is more prone to violence than other things. It seems to me that part of his argument is wonderful, and I found it very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, religion. and maybe you could even speak to this a little bit about just like your work. So as I said at the beginning, you're doing work that has theological elements, that has political, philosophical elements, but it's also a question of history. And one thing that I try to get my students to do, even I actually say that part of like the benefit of studying something like Latin or Greek, these historical languages, is that it helps you try to like you're doing your best to think along with people who are long dead. And you're doing your best to try to take off your blinders and your predispositions or your, you know, these sort of assumptions that you bring to the table when you're reading things. So like, you know, I had been hearing about the Westminster Confession my whole life. I'd never thought to even ask what was the historical situation in which this thing was written. I just had to memorize it. I was a Baptist, but I had to memorize it in sixth grade, and I thought this was preposterous. It felt like this sort of disembodied list of truths that all Presbyterians just knew by heart. That's what I thought. It's probably not the truth, but that's what I must have thought in middle school.
That's right. We all have that experience. We're all along the way. So it's a common experience, I think, that you're narrating.
The part of the work that you do that's interesting is just, you know, is this historical, like, okay, let's take an account of where we're at and try to take off some of these predispositions. So, I mean, is that something that you feel like, was that work that you had to do? Was this, what is that like just being the historian a little bit? The other thing I might follow up and joke with, though, is that some of the guys that were in my PhD program, we were saying that we like doing historical theology because we didn't have to take a position. So we could say, you got to check your assumptions at the door and you have to learn to think like the ancients and all of that. And that is all really important. But also you get the benefit of not having to say, well, I think this.
Exactly. Well, and that does help, especially – well, anyway, that's a whole another conversation. I think you're absolutely right that we all go through this process of becoming more historically aware that the way that we think about things now is different from how the people thought about things in other times and places. And that is also true in relation to theological terms. We just take for granted that theological terms mean certain things, and then we read those meanings into historical documents as if the people before us or in other places or other times are talking about them in the same way. And I think that's absolutely been the case of my own experience. And even in the course of working on this project, I realized in significant ways that I had assumed that what it says in the Westminster Confession of Faith, it means one thing. And then you study the original context and what they're debating, and you realize, oh no, they're using this phrase in a very precise way in order to say these views are acceptable and those views are outside the bounds. And one of the primary things I learned along the way in doing this project is there's actually quite a range of views on the covenant with Moses that they were intentionally allowing for that diversity of views. But there were some things on the periphery that they did want to exclude. So, you know, when it comes to the topic of my book, one of the things you learn is that the covenant with Moses is an administration of the covenant of grace was pretty fundamental to the system. And yet at the same time that there are different administrations of the covenant of grace, and that there are ways in which the law that was given to Adam is re-given to Moses and to Israel is also part of the system. And then you realize, oh, they're doing this complicated dance to try to hold both of those two things together at the same time. And when it comes to contemporary Presbyterians who are thinking about these same things, some like to hang on to one of those halves more so than the other. And you actually get a lot of debates. You know, those who think Moses is gracious versus those that think that Moses is legal or works oriented on the one hand, those who really want to argue for covenantal continuity versus those who really want to observe covenantal differences on the other. Those debates are still going on, and we just read our present day views into the documents.
Yeah. And I know this was when we were going through one of our membership classes for our church, someone mentioned that this is actually one of the cases in the confession that most pastors take their so like in the PCA specifically, you can take an exception. And this covenant of works versus covenant of grace is a primary place where a lot of people, quote unquote, take an exception. And I guess they take an exception to some extent because this is such a contested way of viewing things that it's really hard to get a consensus.
Yeah, that's right. So the confession and the shorter catechism and the larger catechism, they use three different terms for the covenant with Adam in the Garden of Eden. They call it a covenant of works, a covenant of life. And there's also a place where the larger catechism talks about the covenant with Adam being in the state in which he was originally created. So it's in the context of a question about the distinction between providence and creation. Mm. And it says that the covenant of works was a creational situation. And because the documents use all three of those words, some people will get persnickety about which word they want to use. I would just make the case that I would just observe that the confession uses those terms synonymously. Mm. And so if someone wants to choose one of those terms and say the others aren't good, well, that raises some questions for me as to whether or not they actually understand the system that's in the confession. But if they just, you know, if they're nervous about how someone might abuse one of those terms to mean a certain kind of thing, well, that's different. That's totally, if it's just semantic indifference, that's pretty allowable. But if someone really doesn't like one of those terms and wants to say you can't use it, then I start to wonder, is there actually a more substantive difference going on there that's more than just a semantic difference?
Right. Well, we're usually I introduce this question earlier on in the conversation. I think you might have given a kind of answer to it, but I like to ask people, what is one thing that you once thought was true and now think is false, or vice versa? So it has a kind of, it can give you a little entree into the way that someone thinks and sort of how they go about their research. So you did already mention your research a little bit, like some questions over things that you thought were sort of settled, but they're less settled. I also seem to think that I've seen pictures of you on Facebook in a Charlotte FC uniform and also a St. Louis City uniform. So apparently there's something that you once thought was false and now think is true, that St. Louis City is the proper allegiance for a soccer fan in the United States. But I'll let you respond.
Well, as far as allegiances to football clubs goes, we were residents of the city of Charlotte during the inaugural season of their MLS team and regularly went to the games. But then we moved after that inaugural season to St. Louis.
Our inaugural season.
That's right. So we just followed the first seasons. And it was hard not to be a bandwagon fan this last year because the club did so well, and it was really fun to be a part of it. As far as changing views goes, I used to be much more sympathetic to the subservient covenant view of the covenant with Moses.
Okay.
Before I did this project. The idea that the covenant with Moses is a covenant subservient to the covenant of grace, but not identifiable with it. And I still think on the basis of some of the language in Galatians 3 and 4, Hebrews 7 and 8, and also perhaps in the book of Romans, that it is useful to make some distinction between some of the features of the covenant with Moses and that of the covenant, you know, the covenants with Abraham or the new covenant. I also think that if you cease to refer to the covenant with Moses as a covenant of grace, it does create some problems for you. So that was one thing that did change as a result of doing this dissertation.
Okay.
And I do think I've tried to allow the documents to speak for themselves and to be willing to narrate them where they go and not to import my own views into them. But I'm sure I've fallen short of that goal at various places along the way. And so close readers of the book, please reach out to me and let me know where those places might be so that I can grow.
Well, that is helpful. And I don't think, I don't think I was actually there when you were wearing the St. Louis City FC kit. I've always wanted to ask you, cause I know you watch European football. Do you have, like, I watch Arsenal. That's like my team. I always feel a little weird because I don't live there. I have actually been to, two of the Emirates and stuff, but like, I always feel very differently about Arsenal than I do about the Cardinals. Like, I grew up in St. Louis. I know what the Cardinals mean to the city and to people like me who, you know, have been on her dad's knee hearing stories of Bob Gibson. You know, it'll never be the same for me watching Arsenal. So I feel weird calling myself like a real fan, but that's who I always want to win. But do you have a European soccer team that you watch?
I enjoy watching European soccer, especially the English and Spanish leagues. I'm a bandwagon fan though.
Yeah.
I have enjoyed the saga of the last 15 years or so when it comes to Manchester United. I mean, basically since Sir Alex retired, it's been interesting to watch them try to function as a club.
Yeah.
And so I continue to be invested in that saga. But to say that I'm a true fan of Manchester United, I think would be a stretch.
Yeah.
But I do enjoy following them and following the saga. And I do hope that they can get things figured out one day.
As an Arsenal fan, I was quite glad that they were able to take a point off Liverpool this last weekend. But
that's right. That's 0-0. Super exciting.
Yeah.
Super the exciting classic. Game. But they did take a point.
Yeah. I mean, my dad grew up playing football. And so when we were kids, I wanted to play soccer because my best friend's dad was the soccer coach, unique, kind of surprisingly, of SLU. So I've actually been around SLU for a long time. He was really sad at first. He's like, really? You want to watch the game where it's almost impossible to score a goal? Like, that's the one that you were interested in? And I never played American football. I still watch it. My brother did. My brother fulfilled kind of that part of my dad's dream of having a kid, play his sport. But,
I'm a big advocate of the beautiful game.
Yeah.
So you're not going to have a hard time convincing me.
Well, at the very, the way that I sent you this question is pretty vague, but there, you know, at the end of your book, you are sort of highlighting some potential, ways to read or like some responses and things that people might be interested in moving forward from your book. And one of them is about this sort of I think the phrase that you use is something of how theological systems can lead to imbalanced pendulums, I think was the phrase from your book. But could you say just a little bit about like how do you think that systematic theologians will use how will this help us think in the contemporary world about our own theologies and how they respond to the historical work that was done even politically?
Oh, that's a good question to end on. I mean, I could give some examples from the book of theological pendulum swinging. But basically, the thing that I'm nervous about there is the overreaction. So you take one issue and you overreact on it, and you fail to see how your overreaction in that one area is connected to a whole host of other areas, and it creates problems for your theological system. So, for example, there were lots of concerns in the mid-17th century in England about antinomians and the way that they were undermining the law. And so as a result, there was a tendency to affirm that all covenants must have conditions. And it's understandable that they would do that, because they were nervous about these antinomians who are saying, no, covenants are unconditional and, you know, God's going to save you no matter what. And how you live is not relevant to your status before God and things like that. So it's understandable they wanted to push against that. But when you read someone like Thomas Hobbes, who takes those arguments and then says, yes, every covenant must have conditions. Let me tell you about the conditions they have. You must obey the temporal, the civil magistrate, absolutely and without exception, if you would like to be saved eternally. Well, I'm not sure they would have seen that coming necessarily, but maybe they should have been more aware of how their overstatements in one theological area might have opened the door for other problems. I'll just give one other example. Sometimes in covenant conversations, people get nervous about talking about merit. So the reason that people don't like a distinction between a covenant of works and a covenant of grace is because you're creating a situation in which in the covenant of works, there is human merit that determines the outcome for Adam. And now you're making either salvation or at least some kind of reward determined by human faithfulness rather than the faithfulness of God. And it's understandable that people would be nervous about merit-related conversations if you follow the medieval conversations about condign and congruent merit. I do think that creates a lot of problems in the theological system that then, you know, unravel during the Reformation period. And then you get unfortunate statements like the Council of Trent's on those issues and unfortunate statements by Protestants that are moving in the opposite direction. And you just get a lot of unbalanced systems. And I think if you read the more careful theologians during the period, when they're talking about merit in relation to covenant and the covenants of works and grace, they're willing to acknowledge that there can be a covenantal kind of merit that is not absolutely deserving of God's reward, but by God's design, by God's covenant, God has made certain actions rewardable for Adam. I do think that there is an ex pacto kind of merit that doesn't create problems and doesn't commit you to a particular kind of medieval understanding of the relationship between condign and congruent merit. So I think that would just be another example where nervousness about human works can cause you to refuse to acknowledge that the scriptures do communicate anything about the importance of human works or even a situation in the Garden of Eden where human works might even have been rewardable based on God's design. So those would be just two examples of theological overreactions. But the more general principle is just the idea that we ought to be aware that when we overreact in relation to one controversy, it might have unintended consequences for future controversies, and we might cause problems for ourselves if we're not careful.
Excellent. Well, my guest today has been Andrew J. Martin, Dr. Drew, as I know him, also as Andrew's dad, and so our sons happen to be best friends, so we are very grateful that he did become a St. Louis City fan, because otherwise Charlie would have been the only boy in that class. So it's been quite providential, I guess we ought to say. Drew, thank you for coming to St. Louis and for being a part of A History of Christian Theology.
It's a joy to be here in St. Louis. I'm glad that our sons can be compatriots in that way, and it's a pleasure to be with you today. Thanks, Chad.